Welcome, everybody, to another episode of an Investor's Journey podcast. This is another episode from Tips from the Pros, and we're very excited. This is really excited to be able to bring this to you guys, be able to share with you the people that are going to be on these episodes, the wealth of knowledge that they have. So I hope you guys are taking advantage and asking questions and you know, learning as much as you can. That's the point of this, is to give you guys hope during this time. There are people that are still in real estate. They've been through this before. They've been through crisis before, and they're going to keep going through crisis because this is just a thing of our lives, right? So this is something that we're going to keep going through, and I hope all the information that we put out here is helping you. And please send us your questions, anything you may have for us. And we'll do our best to answer them. So I would love to introduce, I'm very honored to have Sam Madrid. And Sam has been somebody that, since I've been in real estate, he's been spoken about so highly, and I had the chance to meet him. And he's a very impressive, very, very impressive investor. Has a great track record. He's been doing this for a while. And I'm very excited to bring him on. So, Mr. Sam Madrid, welcome.
Hi, thank you. Thank you, John. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you guys.
Yes, sir. Thank you. So, let's get started. Real quick, what made you want to get into real estate? What made you choose real estate investing?
So, my parents had a few rental properties when I was growing up. They had about five or six doors, primarily duplexes. So as I was growing up, my parents, my father would take care of the maintenance. He was an engineer, but after hours and weekends, he would take care of the repairs. I would go with him periodically. So I think I felt comfortable seeing my parents with rental properties. So unfortunately, I wasn't the greatest student, and I really struggled throughout elementary, high school, and middle school, and even college. So when I did graduate from college, but when I did graduate, you know, my intention, I've always had the desire to be wealthy. I've always had the desire to have my own business. So after I got married, I married a lady from Mexico, and we got married. We got married in Mexico. We moved back to San Antonio. And I started a job as a salesman selling plastics to the maquiladoras across the border, going back and forth. And I had the desire, though, to have my own business. So the only thing I could think of was real estate, because I'd seen my parents do it. Wow. So I, when I got married, I've always had the ability to save. I've always been a frugal person, and thank you. Thankfully, my wife is too. So when we got married, we had about $20,000 saved up between the two of us. And we lived in a duplex. My parents gave me a one-year wedding present of free rent in one of their duplexes. And after the rent was over, the 1 year was over, they gave me the ability to buy it from a owner finance with zero down. So we lived in one unit, and I guess you call it house hacking. We rented out the other side, and I didn't have a mortgage payment. So we saved everything. And from that, I was able to start saving up down payments to buy rental properties.
So no,
and that's where I got started in real estate.
So no handouts, really. I mean, they sold you the house and everything.
Yeah, they did. They actually did. So I started reading a lot of books. Both my parents are they're both deceased, but they both were very well educated. And that was a blessing, because my parents always educated me on the power of education. Mm. So although I didn't know a lot about real estate other than what I'd seen from my parents, I started reading a lot of books about real estate. And then I started reading everything I could get my hands on. Kind of ironic, from a guy who, as a first grader, wasn't gonna be going to second grade because I still wasn't able to read. And here I was reading as many real estate books as I could get my hands on. And I read a book by Robert Allen called Creating Wealth. And he talked about using credit card cash advances for down payments. So I started getting credit cards and taking out cash advances. And I would come up with 10, 15, and including my savings. And I would start giving them, looking for fourplexes. And I would buy, find fourplexes, giving $20,000 down. And I would take all the positive cash flow, and I would continue to sell plastics and my commissions. I would save up money to go pay off my credit card. And once I got my credit card payoff, I'd go pull out another $20,000 as a cash advance and do it, repeat the cycle.
Wow.
And it really started blossoming and turning out good. I was very good at managing. I've always been a people person. So I was very good at managing people, and I kept a very close eye on it. So there was a good amount of cash flow. And as it started getting better, bigger and better, I wanted to do it more rapidly. So I wanted to grow the business faster. So I received a letter from in the mail from Ron LeGrand. And I, it was, he was a guru at the time, and he still is.
Yeah.
And I can remember him offering a real estate course for $2,000. And at the time, the $2,000 was a lot of money, and it still is, but it was a lot of money back then. This is 25 years ago, because I've been doing it for 25 years.
I was going to ask you, when was all this? When did you start doing all this?
I started, I got married in 94, so I think I started right at 1995. So I've been doing it for a good while. So I went ahead and bought the real estate course, and I paid the $2,000, and when it came in the mail, John, all it was about 35 cassette tapes. And there were these little cassette tapes that probably cost about 10 cents, 15 cents to make or duplicate. And I said to my wife, I said, oh man, I think I got ripped off. I got to look at, I paid $2,000 for what probably cost $300 to make. And, but I started listening to the, to all the cassette tapes, and I was extremely diligent and hardworking. I would stay up till 3 and 4 o'clock. I was so hungry to get education. And he started talking about wholesaling. And I'd never heard the word wholesaling. I had no clue. The way that my parents did it was you go pay retail price, but look for an owner finance deal. You give 20,000 or 20% down, and you do it on a 30-year note, paying whatever interest rate you could negotiate. And that's what I thought real estate was about. So when I got the cassette tapes, it changed my life, because I didn't realize that there was such a thing called wholesaling. So I got my, I said, I'm going to go try it. I listened to all the tapes. It took me about 10 days, and I went. And I put an ad in the paper in the Express, San Antonio Express News, that said that I buy houses cash. And I got a phone call from this gentleman, and he said, I inherited a property over on the east side of San Antonio. It was nothing like it is now. Mm-hmm. It was a war zone. It was right behind the Alamo Dome on the street Olive Street. And he told me, if you will meet me there tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in the morning, I will show you the house. He says, I just inherited the house and I don't want it. And he was asking $15,000 for the house.
Wow.
So I went and met him there at 8 o'clock in the morning. It was a war zone. And I asked him why we had to meet there so early in the morning, because he says that's where all the drug dealers and prostitutes are still asleep and we'll be safe. So I said, fine. And he, when I got, he was this huge guy, and he got out of his pickup truck. He told me not to worry, that he had a gun in his glove box if anything happened. And so he showed me the house. And it was structurally sound, but it was dirty. He said he wanted $15,000. And Ron LeGrand always said, make an offer. So I offered $6,000. And he said that if I could close in a week's time, he would take eight. So we put it on contract. We filled out the paperwork. I took it to Alamo Title. And then the following day, I went to the Express News and I put an ad in the paper for $20,000 as a handyman special. And I get a phone call a couple of days later from this gentleman, elderly gentleman, and he says, "I'll meet you out at the house." And I said, "Great." And I said, "What time?" We met there, and he drove up. It was probably in July. He drove up in a red Ford Pinto with the windows rolled down. And he was basically in an undershirt. It was the hottest day in the summer. And he wrote with no air conditioning. He drives up and he looks at the property. And I said, I'm asking $20,000. I had it under contract for $8,000. He looked around and he said, "I'll give you $12,000. And he says, "Well," he says, "it needs a roof. He needs a foundation. He said it needs to be cleaned." He says, "I'll give you $12,000 and I'll close in 3 days. And I took it. I said, "Okay, we'll do it." So here's a gentleman in an undershirt, July, driving a Ford Red Pinto. And I go home and I tell my wife, "I got it under contract for $12,000 and we're going to make $4,000. So I go to the, about a few days later, I go to the title company. And now I'm starting to sweat it because it's my first deal. And I'm thinking, man, if this gentleman doesn't come in with the $12,000, how am I going to have the money for the closing an hour later for the $8,000? And if he doesn't come in, I'm going to look foolish. So I went to the title agent, the closing escrow agent, and I said, "Mary Jane, I don't know if this gentleman's going to show up." And I said, I just met him. And I said, "I don't have the $8,000. I hope this works out." I was preparing her. So I said, "If it doesn't work out, please don't be upset." So he comes in at 3 o'clock and he was supposed to come in at 3. It's a cash deal. He looks at the closing statement. He signs his name and he throws a cashier's check on there for $12,000. And I said, "Oh my God, it just happened." And the guy showed up, came with the $12,000. And an hour later, the seller came and he sold the property. And I received a check for $4,000. And it was money just out of thin air.
Right.
And I went to Mary Jane. I said, "Can you believe that?" She said, "Sam, you don't know who that was." I said, "No." She says, "You don't know who that was, do you?" I said, "No." She says, "That was Mr. Epstein." She says, "He probably owns over 300 rental properties just on the east side alone." And I said, "Oh my God, here's a gentleman who with over 300 properties here and is in a Ford Red Pinto in the summer." And it was a great experience. So we made
$4,000. Yeah, it was definitely worth the course. I mean,
I was definitely worth the course.
And that's something.
So I told my wife, "If I can do it again,
yeah,
I'm going to quit my job." And I did it again. So I went and quit my job.
And
that's how I started. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's the biggest thing that I tell people. You can buy a $5,000 course, a $500 course, or a $50,000 course. If you don't take action, it's not going to do anything. I got started with a $300 course and that was all I did, but I put in all the work to be able to get to where we are, and it's just, that's amazing though. And what's funny, what you say is that's one thing that I can, with John, we agree on, that you can never judge an investor by what they look like. I mean,
yeah.
Anything has been true is every time I've gone to an event and you see somebody in like cargo shorts and flip flops and they look kind of like, they're just curious. They're probably the one that has the most money. They have all the properties, and the ones with the suits and the nice clothes, they're probably all the ones that are just full of it.
I've learned that lesson that you just can't judge a book by its cover. And that was a prime example. Mr. Epstein had probably well over probably 400 or 500 houses in San Antonio. You would have never known it.
No.
And you would never have known it. And so you just can't judge a book by its cover, a person, what they look like.
It's amazing. So let me ask you, what was one of the biggest challenges that you faced when you first started off? What was one of those things that probably was hard to get over?
Fear.
Fear. Really?
It's absolutely fear. So it was fear of quitting my job. Here I was selling plastics. I had just got married with my wife, and I was going and selling plastics. And you were selling plastics, but you really needed more of an engineering background, because you were selling the plastics, but you really were selling the equipment that would package the packaging of the plastics. And you really needed a technical background. So my degree was in communications. So I was able to do well in the sales because, not because of my technical skills, but it was just because of my personality. I learned that if I could get people to like me, because I was in school, I always struggled in school. I'd learned if I could get people around me to like me, or my teachers to like me, they would help me and pass me on to the next grade. So I applied that same thing in sales. I got very good at knowing people's names, trying to get to know their birthday, and I was very good at getting people to like me. But it was a job that I hated. I did not like it. Mm-hmm. And I did it for about a year, 2 years. And the last 6 months, I could remember waking up in the morning, not feeling nauseous, not wanting to go to work. It wasn't for me. And although I had the burning desire to do real estate, I was still fearful, because I was probably make about $6,000 a month in commissions from my plastics commissions. Right. And I just had that fear of failure. Looking back on it, what I had to fear, I have no idea. I didn't have any car payments. I paid cash for my cars. I didn't have a mortgage payment because I was house hacking. I was renting the duplex. My wife and I always lived very frugally. I had no bills. And what I had to fear about, I have no clue, but it was just fear.
It was, you know, I always talk about when I first started, I send out a ton of marketing. And the phone finally started ringing, and I would just stare at the phone and just not answer. And I was shaking and you don't know why. You don't know what you're afraid of. They're not going to do anything. They're not going to bite you. And now it's just, I'll go knock on anybody's door. Like, just the fear is gone. It's just psychological.
Yeah, it's all psychological.
And how
it's
a great just doing it.
I mean, for me, honestly, the truth is, the way I do it is through prayer. And I just knew that, you know, for me, prayer, meditation, asking God for guidance. And that's, anytime I run through difficult times, personally, that's how I handle things. And, you know, I went out and I just did it. And but it, fear, I mean, it's debilitating. Yeah. You got to be careful. Yeah, with fear.
That's a good point.
It was a fear of loss. And I can remember going to my boss and telling him I was quitting. And you know what he told me, John? You'll be back. And when he told me, "You'll be back," that was the most crucifying words that he could have told me.
That was fire for you.
Yeah, it was, but it also increased the fear factor. So he said, "You'll be back." Yeah, it was crazy.
For me, every time, I don't know why, even as a kid, but every time somebody's challenged me, like, "You can't do that," or "You won't amount to anything," or "You won't get there." To me, it's like, I'll kill myself to prove you wrong. And I don't know if it's right or it's wrong, but, you know, it's always been my driving force.
I think you just got to ask yourself, what's the worst case scenario? Mm-hmm. I don't think I asked that of myself years ago, but if I would have asked, and I do ask that question now,
right,
what's the worst case scenario? The worst case scenario is I would have gone back and sold plastics. I would have found another sales job. And there was no worst case. I mean, that was the worst case scenario. Right. I had nothing to be fearful about, but I was scared.
Yeah. We create our own fears. It's in our head.
Well, let me tell you, this is crazy about fear. Mm-hmm. So the very first duplex, the very first duplex I bought was over off of San Pedro and Hildebrand. And I found a gentleman that would sell me the duplex with $20,000 down. So at the time, I went to my best friend. And I said to my best friend, "Hey, if you come up with $10,000, I'll come up with $10,000. Together, we'll buy this duplex together." And my friend said, "Hey, that's a wonderful idea. The only thing is, I don't have the $10,000. I said to my friend, no problem, don't worry about it. I'll lend you $10,000. So I financed the whole down payment off my credit card because I wanted somebody to hold my hand. I was fear. So I gave up 50% equity, putting up 100% of the down payment just because I was fearful and I didn't have to do the deal alone. That's crazy.
That's hilarious. But at least you still figured out a way to like, essentially trick yourself into doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what matters. And that's hilarious. Because anybody else would have been like, I don't have the 10 grand. Well, damn it. Now I just can't do it. But you knew you had the money.
Because
you needed somebody to go with you.
I needed somebody to hold my hand.
That's hilarious. Tell me about the first crisis you went through and within the market and everything. How'd you deal with that?
Well, let me tell you the real quickly. I went to a real estate meeting. After I started being a landlord and a little bit of wholesale, I went to a real estate meeting. There probably about 15 real estate investors were there. It was at a restaurant on Wurzbach Road, Chinese restaurant. I had the blessing of sitting next to a gentleman by the name of Mitch Steven. I don't know if you know Mitch.
Yes.
Okay. So we sat down next to each other. We struck up a conversation and he started telling me how he had all these rental properties and how miserable it was because he was getting calls and everything and tenants weren't paying and he would have to evict. And so he said to me, you know, I'm going to try a opportunity to sell owner financed. And I said, do it and let me know what happens. So I got to see him at the next real estate meeting and Mitch and I started talking. He says, hey, I sold it owner financed. And lo and behold, I started getting all these postcards in the mail from people that wanted to buy my real estate note. Mm. So I said to Mitch, I said, Mitch, if that works, let me know. And maybe I want to try one with you and we'll do one together. So I saw him at the following real estate meeting. He says, hey, I sold my real estate note and I made $15,000. They took a discount on the note, but I still made a profit of $15,000 in a very short period of time. And I said, hey, Mitch, man, let's do it. Let's try one together. So we tried one together. We got our credit cards out, bought a house together. We sold it owner financed. And we sold that note to a financial institution. So we made our money and we did it again. And then after a very short period of time, I said to Mitch, man, let's form a partnership. So we formed a partnership. And John, we did wonderful. We made a fortune. In the first year, I think we each walked away with about $250,000, not knowing what we're doing. But we both walked away just flipping houses, putting them owner financed, selling them owner finance, collecting a note, selling our note to a financial institution. And we did that for 10 years. I think we probably did it for about 7, 8, 9, 10 years. And we were just pumping them out almost like a conveyor belt. And, you know, it's a relative word, a fortune. But for me at the time, 28 years old, to make $250,000 in the first year, it was a fortune. And we kept doing that every year that went by and we just got bigger and better at it. Well, after a period of time, Mitch and I separated and he went his way. We're still great friends, but he went his way and I went my way. And I was continuously doing the same business and I was selling my notes to that financial institution. That financial institution got bought out. And when they got bought out, the Citigroup that bought the financial institution, they said they were not going to be buying any more subprime paper. So from one day to the next, my financial institution basically put me out of business. That was the first crisis I've ever been to. It was a miserable crisis. Talk about getting on your knees and praying and just seeking guidance and wisdom. The problem that I had done, the issues that I had faced, number one, I had a long-term lease on my office. That was a huge mistake to have a lease. Secondly, I had leases on my copiers and other office equipment. They did not want to let me out of my leases for my copier and other office equipment. Yep. And then third, I made a huge mistake. I had just bought the most expensive Lexus you could find, and I bought it on a lease. And I had all of these things happening to me with my business crashing. So that was the first difficult situation I went to. I had to let the ladies in the office go. I had three ladies working for me. Had to let them all go. I went to the office manager and owner. I offered to pay 3 months in advance in rent if they would let me out of my lease. They agreed. I went to the office equipment, Xerox and different office equipment, asking to release me from my leases. They all refused. So I was stuck with that. And then I was stuck with a very expensive car payment. So that was the first crisis I came through. Well, I went home and I was working with my wife and myself from home, continuing with the same business, not knowing what I was going to do. I read a book from Lonnie Scruggs, who did a lot in mobile home. He's passed away now. I don't know if you've heard him. But he talked about creating your own economy, not being financially dependent on one financial institution, one bank, one private investor, to have your multiple private investors and to create your own economy. That's what it talked about, the article. When I read the article, it hit me like a light bulb. This is what I need to do. So I went out and started cultivating relationships with different private investors, different people in the community that I could start to meet who would want to get a better interest rate on their money, return on their money, secured by real estate. And that's what I did to survive that crisis.
So one thing that I would imagine you took away is don't get so over leveraged that if something happens, you can't get out of it.
Number one, I'll never do office equipment again. I'll only buy it if I need it.
Right.
Number two, I'm not going to get myself in a long-term lease. I'm never going to do another car lease again. I promise you that. I learned that lesson. And third, with an office, I'm going to be very careful. I own my own office now. I'm not going to get where I just financially committed. And you're exactly right. Getting yourself over leveraged and committed, just like in the environment that we're in today. Right. If you told me that a virus would basically shut down the world, I'd say you're crazy. But lo and behold, a virus has shut down basically the whole world.
Yeah.
And never would have thought it. And it happened so quickly. So in another crisis again, but yeah, leverage and debt really can put a business out of business when a crisis hits.
So what was your business model after that? So you started borrowing money from private money lenders. And what was your plan going forward on as far as, you know, this is how I want to run my business. This is how I want to have my investments. How am I going to protect myself?
So what we were doing, Mitch and I were doing, we would find houses that we could buy, working class type neighborhoods, people that work in the trades. And we would buy a house, for example, just numbers from 20 years ago. We'd buy it for $40,000. It needed $10,000 in repairs. So we would buy it for $40,000, have $10,000 for repairs, and we probably would borrow an extra $5,000 for our own expenses in the office. So we'd buy it for $40,000. We'd need $10,000 in repairs. So we'd probably borrow $55,000. We'd go fix it up. We'd put $5,000 in our pocket for living expenses and everything. We'd go fix it up and we'd probably sell it for $85,000. We'd sell it for $85,000 with $10,000 down. We'd have a $75,000 note. And we would take that $75,000 note and we would sell it to an individual who would buy it, preferably at par without a discount. And we would sell it to them where they would get 10, 11, 12% on their money secured by real estate. And that was the business model. When we received the $75,000 down plus the $10,000 down payment, we would go pay off our private lender of the $55,000 loan.
And what got you doing that was Steve was already doing that. So what got you into that whole business model?
No, Mitch and I figured it out together. He did not have that business model. We just started two and two together and figuring out, okay, if we use private lenders to borrow money and we overfinance it a little bit, but we turn around, it's basically a quick flip. It was just a flip. Right. Instead of you fixing up a house and taking it with the MLS, we would fix up the house, sell it on our finance, and we'd come look for a note buyer to get us cashed out to give us our profit. It was just a fix and flip. But instead of doing it the traditional route by finding somebody in an MLS, getting it listed with a realtor, finding somebody that could qualify, we would find somebody who could give us a good enough down payment. We'd verify their credibility on their work and so forth. And then we'd look for a note buyer that would buy that piece of paper from us.
And what time frame was this? What year was this that you were doing that?
I mean, I started in 95, but I'm doing that today. That's all I do today. Yeah. All I do is create paper. I've tweaked it a little bit to do a little bit better. I've tweaked it in a good way without getting overcomplicated. So when you purchase with the intent of buying, when you purchase with the intent of selling right away, you're flipping it.
Right.
Well, tax consequences, you're going to be taxed at ordinary income, which takes a large portion of your profits if you do enough of them.
Right.
So what I did after counseling with different CPAs, I tweaked it, and that's how I do it now. I will put it in inventory as a rental property, and my intent is to rent it for 1 or 2 years. After that time period, I will look for a tenant buyer that will put a substantial deposit, maybe $5,000. I'll give them 2 or 3 years to come up with another $5,000. So in that period of time of them renting it for a year, 2 years time, I get to see how they pay credit wise, number one, but I also get to take advantage of long-term capital gains, which is powerful because it cut my tax rate down to basically half.
So you're pretty much renting it with an option to buy, in a sense?
Exactly. It's a rent. I call it a rent to own. I know in San Antonio or in Texas, you're not supposed to be doing, and I've changed it now. I tweaked it again. I went to a real estate attorney. So before that $5,000 deposit, it was a non-refundable deposit.
Yeah.
Now I'm doing a lease. And I'm putting that $5,000 as refundable deposit. I will give you back your money. After a year's time, if you complete the lease, which is 18 months, and you give me 60-day notice and you leave the house in good enough condition, you decide not to buy, I will return your $5,000 deposit. I will return it to you, but I'm basically from the beginning letting people know that I'm looking for people that want to be homeowners. So although it's not a traditional rent to own and it's really just a lease with a first right of refusal because I'm giving them their deposit, but the vast majority go forward with it because they save up the rest of the down payment and now I've created a note that I have a good track record of how they paid as a renter. And they also, I always tell people, look, you have the best of both worlds because you get to try the house before you buy it.
Right.
When I bought my first house with my wife, well, we had a neighbor that raised pit bulls. And because they raised pit bulls, it was horrible. And once we had already purchased the house, well, there was no way because we already had signed all the paperwork. So we weren't able to give back the house. So what I tell people is, hey, why don't you rent it? Get to know the neighbor, get to know the neighbors, get to know the school, get to know the house itself. And if you decide to buy it, save up the rest of the down payment, and then I'll sell it to you owner financed. If you decide this isn't the right house for me, or we don't like the schools, or we don't like the neighbors, just finish out the lease, give me 60-day notice, and I'll find a different house that I have for you in a different neighborhood, or I'll give you a good recommendation, and I'll give you your $5,000 back. So I've taken all the risk out.
Yeah. I mean, it's a hell of a deal. And then also the tenant, I would imagine it's a different mentality from them because they're going in like, this is my house. So you're not worried about them like trashing it like maybe some other tenants would.
Exactly right. So I always tell people, look, I'm not looking for a renter. I'm looking for somebody that really wants to be a homeowner to have a better life. And I mean that sincerely because, you know, if you look at my background, my grandparents came here from Mexico. They came here with nothing. One generation later, out of 9 children, my mom was the only one to go to college. Out of my dad's side, out of 4 kids, he was the only one to went to college. My parents utilized rental properties in order to finance my college education and my sister's college education. They bought the duplexes when I was a baby, and by the time I was ready to go to college, they sold one of the duplexes, and that's how they paid for my college and my sister's college. So I show everybody how now everybody in my family, at my generation, my age, everybody's a college graduate. And I tell people, look, this is my story. This is how my parents used rental property, real estate, the home ownership, to have a better life for their children instead of just renting. And my parents, my mom had always told me, don't rent. You always have to buy. You'll never be an owner. You'll never get ahead if you're a renter. So that was put into my subconscious. So I firmly believe that I'm giving people the ability. And I tell people my story when they're trying to buy. I don't really sell my houses anymore. I have a salesperson. But I try to educate my salespeople on my story. So, you know, I'm looking for to giving people opportunities to be home ownership. And if it doesn't work, no hard feelings. I give you your deposit back. We part as friends. Just leave the house in the condition I gave it.
I mean, and there's really no risk for you, because even at that point, you held it long enough that if you did want to sell it, you wanted to do whatever, capital gains tax is lower.
Yeah. Yeah. And John, because of that, I have very little turnover.
Right.
But I will have tenants give me the $5,000, and they'll stay there for the next 5, 7, 10 years. They never complete the rest of the down payment, unfortunately, but they continue to stay there. I've now instituted a program where I'm now following up with people to tell them, hey, you gave me $5,000. Now, you know, we put a timetable in a calendar that every 6 months you're going to give me another $1,000. We're going to complete the transaction. I'm just not going to let people give me money and stay there for 20 years. Although that's not a bad thing either.
Right.
Because they're basically paying off the house. And I tell people, look, if you want to stay there as a tenant. But when you're ready to buy, I'm still willing to sell. We just need to renegotiate the price because inflation, I've been paying the taxes, I've been paying the insurance, and values have gone up. So let's just renegotiate the price.
And you're doing all of this with private funds, or are you using traditional funds as well?
I do it all with private funds. I've done it all with private funds.
Wow.
I do have a bank line of credit, but the vast majority is with private funds.
Wow. I mean, it's something that yesterday you were one of the panelists at the Alamo RIA, and one thing that you said is somebody brought up, well, now's a good time for you to renegotiate with your lenders. Because, you know, they don't really have much options, right? Because of where the economy is. And you're like, no, if I can pay them, you know, as is and everything, there's no need for me to renegotiate. The terms are the terms. And I was like, damn, you don't meet people like that.
I mean, I think you do. I appreciate your comment. Thank you. I think you do. I hang around people of integrity, right, and I'm very cautious. You know, my dad used to always tell me who your friends are and I tell you who you are. Because of that, I'm super cautious on who I let into my inner circle, and I'm going to deal. My friends are people of integrity. And so because of that, the way I see the world is, you know, people, the vast majority of people want to do the right thing. I know I do, but I could go squeeze a hard money lender, or I could put them, because they're in a position, they don't want the house back. The vast majority of people that I'm looking for, they're professionals. They're probably older. They've sacrificed their whole life to save money. They want a good return on their investment. And I'm not going to take advantage of people. But, you know, at the same time, I think what the gentleman was telling me is, hey, if you had to, don't do it purposefully to hurt people. But if you had to, you're in a prime. And he's right. I could go and renegotiate if I had to, or go interest only, or do a moratorium. It's just that I have enough properties that are free and clear because I've been doing it long enough that I have enough cash flow that I can pay my regular payments.
And of course, and I think the idea that he gave was a good idea,
yes,
because if you needed to, at least, you know, you do have that option. And that's
right.
Personally, that's why we prefer working with private money lenders instead of getting hard money or bank money, because if things like this happen, we can always go back to a human being and say, hey, let's work this out. Let's make sure we can get through this. You know, we'll do whatever needs to get done. Let's restructure. Let's get through this, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I, I would if I had to in a heartbeat. But my rule is, you know, my lenders are not going to lose anything, and they never have, and they won't. So it's worked out well.
That's great. So what are your thoughts on what's going on right now with this crisis, with the government shutdown? Like, what do you see is going to be maybe the economy moving forward? How do you see it now? How do you see it moving forward?
I mean, I really don't know. It's just, I've never seen anything like it before. I really don't know. All I can do is speculate. For me personally, I'm not buying any houses right now. I regularly buy about 40 to 50, 55 houses every year, doing the procedure that I talked about, the business model, and I've completely stopped buying houses. Why? Just because of uncertainty, not sure what's going to happen. Not sure if, you know, that house that I'm going to buy for $80,000, in 2 months, it may be go on sale for $50,000. I certainly don't think it's going to go up to $85,000 in 2 months or 3 months or 6 months. So why not wait? In my mind, why not wait? Secondly, if there's so much unemployment going on, and I do believe there's a lot of unemployment going on because I'm getting a lot of phone calls from tenants. Well, what is the wisdom in buying this house and letting it just sit on the market? Because I'm not sure if somebody's willing to give me $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 as a deposit just to move in because they're not sure if they're going to have a job. So I've taken the stance of trying to use wisdom and just be patient. Let's see how things play out.
Right.
I've been doing it long enough, you know, excuse me. I think the gentleman that you and I were referring to a minute ago talked about real estate, and it's true. It's not a get rich quick overnight. It's not. It takes time. You have to be diligent. It takes decades. It could take years. So I've tried to educate myself just not to be impatient. I used to be impatient, and just to be more of a patient person. Let's just see what the future brings and try to use wisdom in my business, in my life.
So you're not even trying to, I guess, predict even what's going to happen. You're just like, let me just see what happens and then I'll react accordingly.
Yeah, pretty much. I don't see how you can predict.
Right.
I mean, I think there's unemployment. That's what I'm scared about. You know, I feel I am young. I'm in great shape. I'm healthy. I'm taking precautions. I'm not so necessarily afraid too much of the virus. I'm more afraid of the ramifications economic, and not just for myself, for the community, for the San Antonio, for the country, really. Very concerned about unemployment. Hopefully with the stimulus package, people in unemployment, people can take advantage of it. I know people want to get back to work, but really what could happen, I'm not sure. And I think it's just prudent for myself, at least, to use wisdom and go slow.
Yeah. How has this affected your current investments?
And what, from what standpoint?
You hold rentals. I mean, have you seen?
John, I have a portfolio of rentals and I have a portfolio of mortgages. From what I can tell, there's more delinquency going on in the rental side, probably because it's not their house. They know I cannot evict, and rents are high. You know, my rents are, market rents are high. San Antonio is in a boom, so we've charged high rents. From the mortgage side, I seem to be getting basically all of my payments in. Why? People don't want to lose their house. Yep. They're going to fight like heck not to lose their house where they raise their kids, where they've done work on, where they've already have roots. They're going to fight like heck. Secondly, my rentals on average rent for about $1,100 to $1,200 a month. My mortgages, because you've sold them maybe 10 years ago, their mortgage payment's probably about $600, $700, $800. Well, they know if you lose this $600, $700, $800 payment, you can't go find another house for $600, $700. You can't rent a house for $600, $700, $800 in San. So they're going to fight like heck. And secondly, because of inflation, and you know, payments are more affordable, where they can easily make a $600, $700, $800. So I seem to be getting in my mortgages a lot better than my rentals. And traditionally, I have very few foreclosures, and I have a lot more evictions to deal with. And it's just being you know, an example during this time also.
Yeah. I mean, how many properties do you have right now?
I mean, we're very close to 500 doors.
Jeez. So, I mean, well, that's...
I try to keep an even balance of of doors of between rentals and mortgages, but I have done a lot more on the rental side lately. What my focus going forward, because a lot of this is because of the crisis that we're going on, there's very little turnover with mortgages. It's just consistent cash flow. Every time I have a vacancy, even I just have a vacancy right now off of Perrin Bible in Nacogdoches. The gentleman left it in very good condition. I'm still putting, it's a $1,300 a month rental, probably about $170,000 property, $1,400. I'm still putting in $2,300 in repairs, and he left it in good condition. I'm doing touch-up work. There was a few cracks that I'm doing. There was a tile that was broken. The garage door needed to be replaced. Had to get a cleaning lady. I had to do other things. It's $2,000 on a house that he lived there for 2 years. Conversely, a mortgage, basically, if I do a good job of finding the right people, and I think I do, I'll get paid for the next 30 years without any interruption in income. So going forward, I'm focusing more on the mortgage side to get it more of an even balance of the 250 and 250, because right now it's lopsided. It's very similar to like stocks and bonds. The bonds are like consistent cash flow and the stocks are very volatile. Well, it's the same with the rental properties. The rental that's very volatile. It goes up and down. People leave, people lose their job. People get constant maintenance calls, but with mortgages, it's just consistent cash flow. So I need to rebalance and get them more in line.
But you wouldn't go overbalance on the other side either. You still want a portfolio of rentals?
Yeah, I do want a portfolio because I know what appreciation is about. You're familiar with the Pearl over by San Antonio. Yes. Over in San Antonio, you're familiar with the Pearl.
Yes,
so about 20 years ago, I got a phone call from a gentleman. I used to run an ad in the Thrifty Nickels, said I buy houses cash. He called me and he says, my mother-in-law just passed away. And I never liked her. And he says, if you will come by and look at the house, I want to sell it right away. My wife and I inherited. I said, how much are you asking? He said, $15,000 cash. I said, I went over there. I knew it was a deal. This was 20 years ago. I went over there immediately. I said, I'll give you $8,000 for the house. He says, if you can close in a week's time, we'll do it at 10. I said, done. John, I've owned that house for probably 20 years. I think I just went and I had the same tenant in there for 20 years. I just asked her last year to leave, fixed up the house. The house just appraised for about $350,000 or $400,000. Uh-huh. I bought it for $10,000. Now, she's rented it for 20 years and I didn't do any repairs, hardly any, in 20 years. When I got her out last year, I put $100,000 in to make it really nice for what the Pearl's like, but it just appraised for, I think it was around 350 to 370. So I know the power of appreciation.
Yeah.
So I don't want all of my rental. I want to keep some rentals. I also understand about depreciation, tax consequences, but so I don't want to go completely into notes.
Right.
Also, you got to keep in mind, I have a real estate office. I have property managers working for me. So I'm not taking phone calls direct.
Right.
If I was taking phone calls direct, I'd be burnt out by now. So I have a buffer. I know what's going on, but I never have to speak with a tenant. That helps dramatically with rental properties. When you have a buffer, a third party in there, I don't have to deal with tenants. And before I was dealing with all my tenants, it's a recipe for burnout. But so I'm still want to build up my note portfolio to get more in balance, but I don't think I will always have rentals.
Interesting. Are you?
And the other thing that I thought of is, you know how in stocks, if you follow stocks, they say as you get older, you convert them more to bonds because they're more consistent. Well, I thought as I get older, I will convert more towards mortgages to have that consistent income. But quite frankly, I'm very passionate about the rental properties. I really enjoy the rent-to-own program that I've created. So I'll always be doing that.
Yeah, I rarely meet an investor that's been doing this for decades and they're you know, they're a lot older and everything, that they don't go all in on notes. I mean, the majority of the investors I know, they're just like, just do notes. And I'm like, yeah, I think at your age maybe, but, you know, I still have like a lot to build up to.
Well, you know, I hear what you're saying, but I will respectfully, you know, tell you, I have met investors. Mm-hmm. One of my closest friends does nothing but notes, and we're talking probably four or five hundred notes. He's older, a little bit older than I am. He's been doing it longer than I have, but he probably has 400 or 500 notes, and he has a wonderful life. And he did do some rentals, but he quickly went in directly into the note business. But what I have learned is notes will get paid off. And you know, that note that I sold for $85,000 in the example I was giving with Mitch a few years ago, right, you know, over time, inflation will eat into that mortgage payment. Also, the people that I work with, I generally charge 10 to 12% on my notes. People think they're going to go get refinanced. The vast majority will never go get refinanced, but what they will do, John, they will make extra payments. Mm. So that 30-year mortgage will get paid off in probably 15 years because they'll put an extra 100, 200, 300, or at income tax, they'll put another 1,000, 2,000. They will pay it off much faster. So with the note side is, like my friend that I was talking with that has about 400 or 500 notes, every month he's getting paid off on 3, 4, 5 notes. He's having to consistently reinvest in more notes. Mm. With the rental side, I could see having 100 rental property or whatever number you want to, having them free and clear, and you're done for the rest of your life. And I've thought about that. But, you know, I have met investors that have done very well with nothing but notes. I really have. And quite frankly, I have heard of real estate investor landlords go bankrupt in the 08 crash. I would hear about them going bankrupt where they couldn't make their mortgage payments. I've never heard any of my friends that are only into notes or heavily into notes go bankrupt, because they've always had that consistent cash flow. They never have to worry about the roof going bad. They never have to worry about air conditioning going bad. They never have to worry about turnover the way they have, you know, with rentals, they have to worry about turnover. And there's so many expenses that are unexpected. So if you have a rental property that's only getting $300 cash flow and the air conditioning goes bad, well, there went your cold cash flow for the whole year. So conversely, when I have a note that has $300 cash flow, that's consistent cash flow coming in, because the note, the air conditioning is not my problem. The AC is not my problem. All I care about is they stay in the house. And as time goes on, they're going to, if they default, they're generally going to default in the first 5 to 6, 7 years. After that 5-year, 6-year, 7-year period, it's highly unlikely they're going to default. And if they do default, John, it ain't the worst day either, because you just foreclosed on a house that's probably doubled in value.
Right. Yeah.
So I have met investors that have done very well in the note side.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, I completely agree with your perception of doing it, trying to do it 50-50 of, you know, having some notes and having some rental properties. I think that makes perfect sense.
The downside on the mortgage interest income, it's taxed as ordinary income. Mm-hmm. So you're going to be taxed at a very high rate, where you can offset that with depreciation from the rental property side.
That's smart. So we have a question mm-hmm. in from Jose Valdez, that he, before you were talking about, you had a buffer between you and your tenant. So he's asking, are you referring to a third party property manager or someone
yes.
you hired?
So I have my own property manager that works in my office and works exclusively for us. So we have our property manager, and that has given me longevity because there was no way that I would be able to be a landlord for 25 years taking my own phone calls.
Right.
And when something breaks, she gets the phone call. She's a licensed realtor. She has office. I have a staff of probably about 4 or 5 people. maintenance and insurance and everything, they have office hours. So they're not getting, and they go home at 6 o'clock every day. So they're not getting phone calls at 10 o'clock at night. When I was doing this myself, I mean, I'd get phone calls at 7, 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night. So because we have traditional office hours, if it's not a dire emergency, they don't hear about it. And quite frankly, I don't hear about it till Monday. Wow. And if it's minor, drippy faucet, whatever, refrigerator, I don't hear about it at all.
Well, it's funny because Sharon Fernandez, I don't know if you know her, but she just commented, any chance we get to listen to our boss tell his stories and give us wisdom is amazing.
Oh, thank you. She's wonderful too. We've been working together for quite a while. She's a large portion of my success.
How long have you guys been working together?
You'd have to ask her. I want to say 17 years. I'm almost positive it's 17
goodness.
Years.
Wow.
Yeah. But she's a large portion of my success. You know, she compliments me. I'm a salesman at heart, mm-hmm. entrepreneur. I, quite frankly, John, and it's embarrassing, but I don't even have her computer. I'm borrowing my wife's computer. You know, it's not my style. I didn't do well in school. I don't know how to use a computer. I do know how to use my iPhone. So Sharon compliments me on my weaknesses, but I'm a salesman. I'm very good at talking to people. I'm very good at raising private money. I enjoy it. And Sharon and I, she's very good in the office. She's our office manager. So her skills complement my strengths.
You know, and that's one thing that I found with a lot of successful people is it's a common trait with you is your ability to understand partnerships, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you respect partnerships and you respect the ability of partnering with people that can complement your strengths or can give you that what you need. And that's so important.
I think we have a tendency to look for people like ourselves. And that's what I did with Mitch. When Mitch and I got together and we were buying anywhere from 80 to 100, he's identical to me. He's probably more of an entrepreneur than I am, but we're identical. We're both salesmen. So when it came to paperwork, it was like, what's paperwork? We do things on the hood of our car. We'd sign contracts and that doesn't work because sooner or later that'll catch up to you where you're not having the paperwork in place. So me being able to work with Sharon, she's very diligent when it comes to the office, when it comes to systems. She loves working with systems. So we complement. But people have a tendency to look for people of their own strengths instead of their own weaknesses.
Yeah, I completely agree. We actually have another question. Will Pritchett, he asks, at how many doors did you hire a property manager or at how many doors do you recommend hiring a property manager?
I mean, that's a great question. I think a lot of it's a function on cash flow. You know, it's important to know the management side, but quite frankly, I've always made money on the buys. I've always made money finding private investors, and there's just not enough time in the day to be an expert at the property management side and look for more deals to buy and looking for more private investors to come, you know, to partner with me on. So I think it comes down to, you know, cash flow. If you have enough cash flow, and I think it also comes down to what your wishes are. You know, there's a lot of people in this community, in this world, that they don't need to be a Mitch Steven. They don't need to go out and buy, you know, my life in 1,000 houses. He doesn't need to do that. I think I know I've bought over 1,000 properties. You don't need that to have a good life.
Right.
I think you could have a very good life with 10 rental properties, 10 notes, 15 notes that are free and clear. Or mainly free and clear. So I think it all comes down to what your desires are. Me personally, I when I was younger, I had the grand vision of being like a Donald Trump and you know, the sky's the limit and so forth. You know, as I get older, it probably isn't gonna happen and it probably isn't necessary, but I get bored very quickly. And I've also come to the conclusion, Sharon and I were having a talk, that I'm a deal junkie. And, I really am a deal junkie. It's been very difficult for me tonight not buy properties this last few weeks. And I made a promise to myself, and I think I made it to Sharon a couple of weeks ago, that I was going to go 2 months without buying a house. And I'm a deal junkie. And I just that sense of euphoria of buying a house where you bought it at 50 cents on the dollar and you can go create a note and make a $40,000 profit. But, and going back to the gentleman's question, I think you have to ask yourself, you know, what is my vision? What am I trying to accomplish? If you're just trying to have financial freedom, you don't need to have 500 notes. You don't want to have 500 notes or dealers. You just need to have 15, 20, whatever your number is. If you're more like me, that you get bored easily and you want to have that drive to get ahead and do more and bigger things, well, then you do need a property manager. So I think that's a pretty good answer to his question. Find out what you're trying to accomplish.
And I think, you know, this is why I love talking to people with your level of experience, because, you know, the wisdom of you need to figure out what makes you happy is what a lot of people don't understand. They always feel like, oh, I need to be a millionaire. I need to do this in order to be happy. It's like, you'd be surprised at how happy you can be with maybe $150,000 a year, right? $150,000 a year. Like, you don't need to be making $1 million.
Absolutely. I don't. I mean, I live in a very modest home. I drive used cars, and just that doesn't throw, you know, for me, it's not to have. Okay. For me, it's just money's a game, and, you know, how much money you can make. It's just how well am I playing the game? It's just a game, and that's all it is. And, you know, I feel like I go out and I play the game in Monopoly every day. And the day I don't feel like playing Monopoly, I feel like going on a trip. My wife and I take a lot of short vacations. You know, I don't play for the day. But it's just a game, and you just got to find out. But you're exactly right. People think, oh, I need to have $1 million to be happy. Don't need $1 million to be happy. You can do it on $150,000 or less, especially if you have no debt.
Well, it's surprising when I heard the stats of how the 1%, what's considered the 1% is making what, $440,000 a year. That's already considered the 1%. So you're thinking, you know, I need $1 million so I can have this extravagant lifestyle, when the 1% already is just 400 grand a year. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's just figuring out what that is for you.
Right. Figuring out what it is for you. Exactly right.
Yeah. Sharon does say, well, though, that...
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Sharon is saying that you are going through withdrawal symptoms from not buying. So...
I am. It's very challenging. So when I told you about that crisis where the financial institution closed down and I wasn't able to sell any notes, you know, we're making $50,000-$60,000 a month just by bundling our notes together, selling our notes off, and money would come in. And it was on automatic pilot. And for all that to come to a screeching halt, you know, not having those big checks come in, it was basically withdrawals. And I actually felt like going through a drug addict withdrawals. And it was really, more than anything, John, it was that sense of euphoria when you get big checks, or when you have a lot of rental properties come in and you have all the monthly checks and going to deposit them or whatever you do to put them in the bank. It's that sense of euphoria that I was addicted to. And it's very, it's crazy how the brain works.
That's funny. So you're not buying anything right now, but are you selling?
One other thing, advice I can give. So I have an adult daughter, and she's 32, and I think she has about 40 rental properties, which I'm really proud of. But so I told my daughter Madison, because she didn't want to be taking all the phone calls, but she didn't have enough cash flow to come in to hire a property manager. So I said, Madison, go find a realtor who can still do their traditional real estate, but can manage your properties part time. And she did it, and she found a great person who's a licensed realtor who can continue to do her traditional real estate, but still have part-time income, and it was a win-win. So that might be a recommendation for somebody who doesn't want to give up all their cash flow and just having a part-time realtor working as their property manager.
Wow, that's great advice. We've actually been considering doing that with our rentals, is bringing on a part-time realtor to help manage
the
properties.
And they're licensed. Leasing. Yeah. Yeah, they're licensed.
We had this past couple months, we had like three properties hit the market at the same time, and just trying to lease it ourselves. Well, John trying to lease it him and everything. I mean, it was just It was ridiculous.
I think you got to take a look at where do I make the most amount of money?
Yes.
Yep. And where I looked at it, where I make the most amount of money is by creating notes and selling off notes. I can make a tremendous amount of money doing that. I don't really make money by managing the properties. It's very necessary. It's a highly skill that I, I really respect the ladies in my office, tremendously respect their expertise, but it's not my expertise. So I'm smart enough to know to let somebody who's smarter than I, and they enjoy it. They're passionate. Sharon's passionate about property management. I know Sandra in my office and Mariel are, they're passionate about it. And I like it too. It's just not my, that sense of euphoria, what I do best of creating notes. I interrupted you on a different question. I'm sorry.
Yeah. The question before was that you're not buying any houses, but are you selling any right now?
No, I'm just staying where I'm at.
Just not making any decision, just kind of sitting right. Put and seeing what happens.
Right.
Okay.
I think we're going to, so I have a gentleman that I partner with a lot, and he owns his own company, but I find the financing for his company, and we structure it where his company buys it. I find the financing, and then we look for a note buyer to purchase. We're with him. His name's Edwin. We're going to touch the water a little bit, I guess you would say, here in the next couple of weeks to see if we can find some more better discounted properties, because the market has been extremely hot for the last few years. Very difficult to find properties at very discounted prices. So we're going to start putting out feelers to see if we can buy from wholesalers or on our own at more discounted prices. But me personally, I'm not. I'm just going to wait, and I may go the rest of the year without buying a house.
Wow. So
kind of like I shouldn't say it, but go ahead.
What?
I have a friend who drinks, and he's going to go the whole year without drinking. So I'm going to probably join him, not on the drinking side, but go a whole year without buying a house. So anyway. I shouldn't say that.
Yeah.
He drank a lot, and but he made the commitment to go a whole year without drinking. And I told myself, I think I could go. Let me see if I could go a whole year without buying a house.
Yeah, it'll be but I think your habit is a little less destructive.
Yeah.
For the people? So there are people that are still going to be buying and investing in real estate right now. What's a strategy that you think they should be focusing on with these level of uncertainties in the market?
Well, first off, let me say, just because I'm not buying, it's a personal decision. Mm-hmm. Also a challenge with Sharon. So it's more of just a personal decision. And what's right for me doesn't make it right for anybody else. I know Edwin is, he's younger than I. He has a family to feed.
Right.
I have the luxury of doing it for long enough that I can just sit back and do nothing. And I'm blessed. I'm the first one to say that I'm blessed. I have that luxury not to do anything, John. But for example, Edwin, he's younger than I, and he's got a family to feed. He's got to get out there and hustle and get deals going. So what's right for me doesn't necessarily make it right for others. What I would recommend to people, if they are looking for houses, you just got to be very careful that you're not catching a falling knife, as they say in the stock market. Mm-hmm. The property that you're buying for $80,000 that is worth $120,000, you've got to be very careful that 6 months from now, it's not worth $90,000 and you bought it for $80,000. That's what you've got to be very careful about.
So no particular strategy, like focus on maybe structured notes or rentals, like it's just try to buy with.
I think everybody's got to figure out what they do best. I think also, I believe it's going to be very difficult. It has been very difficult for wholesalers. I've been contacted from a lot of wholesalers and they've told me that other people are not buying. I myself am not buying. And I hear that a lot just because of uncertainty. I think it depends on what niche you are. If your niche is rental properties, I think you could go out and find deals. I think you should be selective, and I think you got to drive a hard bargain. I think now's the time to drive a hard bargain because, take advantage of the situation, not taking advantage of people, but just the situation that we're presented. And you can buy properties at 50 cents, probably 50 cents on the dollar now. And so if you're going to be a landlord, I think now's the time to do that. You know, if you're going to look for houses to buy with the intent of creating a note, the same thing. You can buy them at deeper, you should be able to buy them at deeper discounts right now. A lot of hard monies have pulled back. A lot of lenders have tightened up. A lot of people are getting, you know, are nervous, and rightly so.
Any similarities that have you seen between now and what happened, let's say, in 2008?
No. Similarities? Well, yeah, I do. So back in 2008, we would go to the RIA, and it would be a huge group of RIA, and we would always go to the RIA, and afterwards we'd go have a glass of wine, whatnot, talk. What I noticed is the vast majority of people that were doing it, they were over-leveraging. They would do the cash-out refis. A lot of the people were doing it before the 08 crash. The vast majority, if not all of them that I knew, are not in real estate anymore. So a lot of people went into other industries. If this goes for a prolonged period of time, I'm sure the same thing's going to happen, because people cannot survive without having paychecks, especially if you're a wholesaler or if you're flipping houses. But it depends on how long the shutdown is going to go for. If it's going to be for a shorter period of time, I think more people will be able to survive. So I think a lot of it determines, but those are the two similarities that I could think of. You know, in the 08 crash, I didn't see it coming, but a lot of people said they could see it coming. Obviously with the virus, nobody saw it coming. I mean, it was from 1 week to the next. I went on spring break. When I came back, the world was changed.
Yeah, it was a huge shock. So finishing up here, I want to be respectful of your time. It's been amazing, the amount of wealth you've given, information and everything. It's been amazing.
Thank you.
For a new investor jumping into the market right now, what's your recommendation to them? Somebody that's brand new, hasn't done anything, and they want to seize the moment.
I guess my recommendation is, now's the time. If values drop, if people, some competition goes away, you're sitting on an opportunity to make a gold mine. You really are. It could be very possible that if things are shut down for a longer period of time, some people cannot make it. People drop out. And also if credit gets tight, like it's starting to get tight, it could become a market for people to buy properties at great discounts. So we may be sitting an opportunity. If people are interested in real estate, now may be the perfect time to get started. No different than after the 08 crash. You know, after the 08 crash, there was plenty of foreclosures to pick up. And a lot of people that I study and so forth made a fortune being able to buy properties and apartments at this time when there was a lot on the market. So it could be a huge opportunity for many people, John. I think it's just to focus on one thing. You know, that's one thing that I've tried to do. I just decided that I was going to become the very, very best that I could be at the rent-to-owns, at the working class rentals, and the notes. It's all fits in the same thing. It's low income properties. And you know, that's all in the eye of the beholder. For me, it's not low income. It's just working class neighborhoods. And the areas that I feel very comfortable with, and people I feel very comfortable working with. But I just said, I'm going to be very good at one thing, and I'm going to become an expert. I'm going to master my craft at one thing. And I mastered my craft just at what I thought I would be the best at. I don't flip houses. I flipped house one time years ago with Mitch, and I think we walked away with $2,000 each. I'll never do that again. You know, I don't get into expensive houses. I do very little subject twos. I have a few, but not many. I do one thing and I do it well. Got bored, and I've tried other things, and I always pay the price. I think I shared with you mobile homes last night. Yep. Where I lost $60,000. I bought a house over in King Williams, probably $1 million home that I bought a few years back. And I have $800,000 of my own money, and I've yet to make a dime out of it. So I've learned And sometimes I make the mistake and I try other things, and it's called boredom. But I always, you know, have come back to what I know what to do best.
And I think you're the living example of sticking to what you know, because, I mean, you've been, it seems like you've been doing owner finance since pretty much you started. I mean,
yeah,
it's amazing.
Yeah. My kids tell me, stay in your lane. My wife, my kids, my office wife, Sharon, always says, stay in your lane. So I'm learning, and I'm getting much better at just staying in my lane, doing what I know best.
So we're going to take one last question. It's John Barr. So I don't know if you know this gentleman. Do you think foreclosures will get as high with the government allow? You think foreclosures will get as high with the government allow up to a year forbearance on federally backed loans?
I have no clue. I have no clue, to be honest, just being honest with you.
Yeah.
You know, from what I've heard is that they were going to do a forbearance, and then they were going to expect in the fourth or fifth month all the payments at one time that were put on hold. You know, if that happens, it's going to be very difficult. I think it all comes down to employment. If, you know, what I've heard, I know the president is trying to get the economy up and running, but even if the economy is up, is it going to get back to normal? I know for myself, you know, as an example, going to church, you know, we've been doing online church. I don't know that I'm going to go back to the big church that I go to for a long time. Don't know if I'm going to go back to the restaurants. Don't know if I'm going to start, you know, and people need to spend money. So there's so many unknowns. I have no clue about the foreclosures.
So parting question, last one, is everybody right now is very scared, very overwhelmed, very stressed out with what's going on. This is the first time for a lot of us that are going through a crisis like this. What advice do you have people that are just so overwhelmed with everything? They're so stressed out. They're just, you know, anxiety is just creeping up on them. What's something that you're using to perhaps deal with all this?
You know, I guess I ask myself the same question. What's the worst case scenario? If I lost it all, what's the worst case scenario? You know, I know my wife's still going to love me. I know my kids are still going to love me. I know I've got great health. And you know what, John, if I lost it all, I'll just go do it again. And I'll probably do it again in half the time because I have the knowledge. And it doesn't worry me.
Yeah.
It really doesn't worry me. And I'm not fearful. And I don't think people should be fearful, because if you live in fear, it's horrible to live that way. And the honest truth, John, we're going to get through it, and people are going to get through it. And this is going to be behind us one day, and probably like 9/11, something I'll never forget, or my grandparents, the Great Depression, they never forgot about it. It'll still be in the, registered in my brain. But at the end of the day, we're going to get through it. And I know we are. And there's still going to be a need for housing. There's still going to need be a need for owner financing. There's still going to be deals to be made. And that's the honest truth, that we are going to get through it, and people will get through it. There's no need to be fearful, and there's no need to live life in fear. Just, we know that we'll get through it. You ask yourself what's worst case scenario. And if you had to start over again, no big deal. We start over again and you do it in half the time because now you have experience behind you.
Yep. Well, I think that's a great way of ending this. What an amazing advice. I completely agree with you 100%. You know, we're going to go through it anyway. Just don't live in fear and get through it with your family. And just what's the worst that can happen, right?
Right.
So, Sam, thank you so much for your time. This has been amazing. The people that watch this, if you guys understand the value that you've shared, the strategies that you've shared some huge insights to how to do deals. I mean, amazing. And I really thank you for everything that you do for us.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it. I hope it helped. And thank you. We'll be in contact.
Yes, we will. So thank you very much for your time. Thank you all for watching. And stay tuned for the next episode.
Bye-bye.